MacCast, Wednesday, November 2nd, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. You know, there is a ton of stuff to talk about today. I have been prepping this show. It actually has taken a little bit longer than I would really like because it's just lots of content coming in, either feedback from you, got a lot of great questions and comments and things to talk about with syncing and iPhone 4S and all that sort of stuff. We also have a bunch of great news to get to. Lots of things happening in the Apple Mac world to talk about. But before we get into all of that, let's take a quick moment. Thank one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, I can't stress enough how much this application has just sort of worked itself into my daily routine. And I know I if you've been listening to the show for a while, I've talked about this in the past, but it really just ends up being true. I got Notebook, I can't even remember how long ago, long time ago, just for taking notes, for doing outlines and things like that. And then slowly discovered that I was turning to it for a lot of other stuff. And now it's become a really great research and sort of compilation tool, a place where I can pull together a lot of information on different projects, different things that I'm working on. And I think the reason for that is because, you know, a lot of people think about it like just an outliner or something for taking notes, but it really is exactly what its name says it is. It is a notebook. It is like a digital virtual version of an actual physical notebook, all the way down to the metaphor. And I think the metaphor is kind of what, and by metaphor, I mean the metaphor in the UI, that's kind of what really makes it work, because it works just like a physical notebook. You have pages, you can set the kinds of paper you want. So if you want graph paper or ruled, you know, wide ruled, narrow ruled, college ruled paper, you have tabs, you have all those things that you would use for organizing a traditional physical notebook, a real world notebook. You have that within the application, and you can customize and you can tweak all that stuff and really get down into some nitty gritty. And you can do things like drawing, and you can use drawing tools, or you can even draw with a stylus. You can hand write stuff in there if you'd like. You can throw in sticky notes. You can put in flags to call out different bits of information that you need to may need to come back and review. And you can clip stuff in there. You can clip in all kinds of multimedia, movies, photos, insert PDF documents right inside there. So you can get everything kind of grouped together in one place using the Notebook application. And once you start playing with it, it becomes very, you realize this is very powerful. This is something that you can really use in your daily workflow and the things that you're doing. But you really don't have to take my word for it. They have a demo available on their website. So if you haven't tried it out, you should head over to circusponies.com right now. Download the application and just play with it. See if it's going to work for you and work into your workflow. I have a feeling it will. Actually, I know it will. So I know you're going to love it. Check it out, circusponies.com, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. And so what do you say we dive into some of the Apple and Mac news, the things that have been going on in the community? I want to kick off talking about Apple acquiring another mapping company. Apple actually was suspected of acquiring a company called C3 Technologies. It's a Swedish-based company. That was earlier this year, but it wasn't really confirmed until just this week. The company itself, what they do, they make this really amazing 3D mapping technology. I mean, literally, the models in this thing look almost like video. If you've seen any of the images online or seen, I think there's a YouTube video floating around that kind of shows how they do this. They use some truly amazing technology. I think the data itself is actually gathered by like helicopters or airplanes that fly over and then do an analysis, like an elevation style analysis of regions, and then they map textures and information on top of this stuff, but the images coming out of it are truly spectacular. I think someone told me someplace that it's military technology, originally developed for the military, which is where a lot of this cool stuff really starts out. Siri itself was a DARPA, you know, government-funded project originally, if you go back and look at the history of it. So it's cool technology coming out, and Apple just bought this company. And it's, as I said, the third acquisition in mapping technology that they've had in recent years. They acquired a company called Poly9 and another one called PlaySpace that make map technology. So I think there's no doubt that Apple is looking to eradicate at some point Google Maps technology from iOS. I think actually Apple would like to get rid of any Google technologies that are in iOS, at least the core of it. You know, they want to get it out of Apple's apps. I don't think they're going to stop Google from putting their own apps within the App Store, but I do think that Apple wants to separate themselves now that Google's doing Android. They want to separate iOS, the core of it, from any third-party technologies and kind of do their own stuff. And having really cool maps and geolocation stuff is going to be pretty critical, I think, to the company going forward. Ars Technica pointed out sort of how these three companies and their technologies could be used in concert. And when you read about this and you start thinking about it, it becomes very, very interesting. So C3, this new company Apple just acquired, could provide an accurate database of this 3D mapping data, these really cool visualizations. And then Poly9 can connect that mapping data up with data from other sources to kind of create these unique visualizations. So this is related to like businesses and companies and street names and stuff like that, the kind of overlay on top of that. And then PlaySpace had this incredible API that Apple could leverage and then make available to developers so they can tap into the mapping technology. So you sort of bring all these things together, and you what you end up with is this incredible photoreal 3D maps that can overlay street level traffic data, business data, other kinds of data based on your location and present it in this kind of really cool augmented reality type way. And then that's integrated into the core of the operating system so that developers can easily leverage it through open APIs that they can just tap into. And you put all that together like that, and you kind of have this cohesive, really amazing solution for maps that I think is even one step, or could potentially be a one step above what Google has available with their mapping technology. And then you layer on top of that the other core technologies built into iOS, things like Siri, and you really start to see that the possibilities for this become endless. I mean, in one word, this is just cool stuff. So hopefully, you know, who knows how far along Apple is. Probably we're at least 6 months, maybe a year from really seeing this integrated into iOS. I would imagine iOS 6 is when we'll see this come on board. I don't think we'll see it come in between, sort of at a point release, but you never really know what's going on internally at Apple. And I'd love to have it sooner than later, but I think probably a feature for iOS 6. But that came out this week and something really cool to check out. Another really cool, interesting story happening this week is related to Apple's retail stores. They've actually been testing this new service in California and New York that allows you to make purchases online or through the Apple Store app on iOS and then pick up your items in store at their retail locations. I think Apple has... Oh, I know it's over 300 retail locations worldwide now. I think initially what they're working on right now is just going to be in their U.S. stores. Rumors are that they're expanding this program that they've been sort of testing in California and New York to other flagship stores in the U.S., and they're going to be launching this Thursday along with an updated version of the Apple Store app for iOS. So in essence, I think 9to5 or one of the sites did a breakdown on based on the information they've been receiving. And the way it would work is you order your stuff online or within the app, and then you pay for it in the app, I believe through your Apple ID. And then within 12 minutes, and it was kind of interesting because they were very specific about this 12-minute window, and it even breaks down to how long it takes them to receive the order at the store, how long someone goes, you know, out onto the floor to kind of pull your items and get them ready, and then they have like an 8-minute buffer for you to get into the store, and they'll have it ready for you. And then you can just walk into the store, walk up to any one of the representatives there, Apple employees, and then they will bring your item, and then you sign for it, and you kind of walk out. It's really that easy because it's already paid for. And they did note that if you go online and there's items that aren't in the store, or you're, say, you're building a custom, doing a custom build of a Mac, what they'll do is they'll ship it to the store for free, and then you will get notified via email or through a push notification from the app that your stuff is ready for pickup. And I think that also happens even when you just do the direct ordering online. You can get the push notification. They'll tell you when it's ready for pickup in the store, and then you just go in and you pick it up. And along with this, another cool feature is the program's going to offer the ability to order online, have it shipped directly to your house like they normally do. But then if you need to process a return, you'll be able to also return in store. So all of that is cool in and of itself. But then there's another part of this rumor that gets a little freaky to me, or a little bit strange, but still very cool. It's a new self-checkout system that's going to be built into the app that'll allow you to, in essence, walk into the store using the Apple Store app, scan an item off the shelf with your camera on your iPhone, your iPod Touch, using the app. It'll pay for it automatically with your Apple ID, with the credit card that's attached to your iTunes account and your Apple ID, and then you walk out of the store. And according to Boy Genius Report, they're not even going to be checking the purchase. I don't know how that's even possible. That's something I'll only believe when I see it. But reportedly, internally, Apple's geniuses are calling it Easy Theft, which is a play on words from their Easy Pay system, which is the little terminals they use in store currently, where you walk up to anybody, any one of the Apple employees there, and they can scan your item and then check you out. So if that really happens, if that goes live on Thursday, I'm going to have to run into an Apple store and test it out and just see. It's going to be really weird to kind of buy your own item, pay for it yourself, and then just walk out the door with it. It's going to feel like stealing a little bit, but very cool. And a lot of people are saying could kind of change the face of kind of how retail works, but remains to be seen. Either way, it sounds like Thursday we're going to be seeing some updates to the app and the rollout, at least here in the U.S. And then I would imagine it would follow internationally, but I don't know how quickly. And speaking of some things internationally, some numbers came out from Reuters this week that Samsung overtook Apple in the most recent quarter to become the world's largest maker of smartphones based solely on the last quarter unit sales numbers. And looking at the last quarter, Samsung unit sales were up 44% over the prior quarter, while Apple was down about 16%. Now, these numbers are for last quarter and don't really account for the iPhone 4S, of course, but Apple was likely down a bit because everybody was waiting. I mean, there was all this news about a new iPhone coming out, a 4S or a 5, so I think it's not surprising that Apple had a slight downturn in their last quarter numbers, and I would say they more than made up for it in that first weekend of iPhone 4S sales, 4 million units in one weekend. So I think come next quarter, Apple will probably regain that lead. I think Samsung and Apple will be playing some back and forth for a while. But I do also think that in the long run, Samsung, and I think we already know that Android, those devices and the operating system are going to ultimately overtake iOS. But Apple's never been about the unit numbers, about gaining the most market share in terms of unit sales. They want to have a good chunk of the pie, and they absolutely do. But I think the bigger thing for Apple is they want to be profitable and they want to make money. And on that front, they have a gaping lead. Apple is the revenue leader in smartphones by a wide, wide margin. And I don't think anybody's going to be catching up with that anytime soon, and especially when Apple continues to put out great products. I mean, the iPhone 4S is the best-selling iPhone to date. And I think when the iPhone 5 comes out, it's going to be even bigger. Apple pushing into more markets, in with more carriers and things like that. And that really leads to these large profit margins and sales numbers for Apple, and I think that's where the proof is. The proof is in the pudding, as they say. Also, Apple is continuing to launch with the iPhone 4S internationally. It went on sale in 7 countries at the initial launch: the United States, Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Japan, and the UK. And then later in October, they launched in another 22 countries, including Austria, Belgium, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, Hungary, Ireland, Italy, Latvia, Liechtenstein, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Mexico, Netherlands, Norway, Singapore, Slovakia, Slovenia, Spain, Sweden, and Switzerland. Whoa, that's a mouthful. 22 other countries in late October. And then this Friday coming up, on November 11th, they're going to launch into another 13 countries. So this is about the most aggressive rollout schedule I think we've seen from Apple on an iPhone launch. In case you're wondering, those 13 countries are Albania, Armenia, Bulgaria, El Salvador, Greece, Guatemala, Hong Kong, Malta, Montenegro, New Zealand, Panama, Poland, Portugal, Romania, South Korea, all getting the iPhone 4S very soon, coming up this weekend. And then Apple has already said it plans to roll out the device into 70 countries by the end of the year. So Apple's, you know, end of the year quarter numbers are going to be huge when it comes to iPhone 4S. Again, I think they might regain the lead from Samsung, but even if they don't, I think it ultimately doesn't matter because they definitely have numbers where it counts. And if I was to tell you that Apple is set to launch in one more carrier in the States, you might be thinking T-Mobile, and you would actually be wrong. Apple is making plans to launch with a small regional operator that operates in Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Georgia, and Florida called C-Spire. Turns out, actually, that T-Mobile uses kind of an odd band for their GSM network that the iPhone doesn't really support in terms of the data, or at least that's what I've heard. So C-Spire actually uses CDMA technology, just like Sprint and Verizon. Of course, Apple on AT&T, Sprint, and Verizon in the States so far. The big differentiator for C-Spire is they're trying to use their pricing and unlimited data plans to kind of win over iPhone owners or potential iPhone owners in the region. The pricing of the device itself is the same with the carrier subsidies, but they offer an unlimited data plan with 500 talk minutes for just $50 a month, which sounds like a really, really good deal until you read the fine print where it says it limits any streaming services to just 30 minutes a month. I'm not sure exactly how they do that, how they figure out that you're using streaming services, but they must have some sort of method. So there's also a $70 plan that has a little more talk minutes, but still the limited streaming. If you want to get true unlimited, as most of us think about it, you need to buy one of their $90 or $100 a month plans that offer truly unlimited data. So if anybody is in those regions and has been a C-Spire customer and had a data plan with them, I'm curious to know if you know how that kind of streaming limiting works. But not a really good deal if you can't. I mean, the whole point of unlimited data, I think, for most people is that they can stream stuff. That's the only time I go over my sort of 2 gigabyte data limit. And I'm grandfathered in on my AT&T unlimited data plan. I don't want to give it up because I'm just afraid that at some point I'm going to be using a lot more data. In reality, when I look at my bill every month or how much I'm actually using, I use less than the 2 gigabytes, which would be a cheaper plan for me to buy on AT&T. But when I'm actually doing streaming using Pandora a lot in a given month, that's when I will actually go over that 2 gigabyte limit. So it's kind of no point in having unlimited data if you can't do streaming, at least in my opinion. But C-Spire, although they're a little bit smaller than the major carriers, still has something like 800,000 customers, and I have a feeling they're going to get more with the iPhone 4S. And I think they cover some of the areas down in the southern part of the states that maybe the big three or four don't really cover quite as well. So good news if you're in those regions and are planning on getting an iPhone, you now have another carrier option, which I'm all for choice. I think choice is really great. And the more carriers Apple can get the iPhone on, the better it is for us as consumers. Apple pushed out an update for GarageBand on iOS. Version 1.1 adds support for the iPhone and the iPod Touch. Up until this point, GarageBand had only been available to run on iPads. The update is pretty large, about 500 megabytes if you want to download it. It is universal, so if you already own GarageBand for the iPad, you'd get the update and you'll be able to run it on your iPhone or your iPod Touch now, along with support for the smaller iOS devices. It also brings the ability to create custom chords for smart instruments, add support for 3/4 and 6/8 time signatures. You can reset the song key without having to transpose your original recording. It now has different additional quantization options for recording, including straight, triplet, and swing. New audio export quality settings for AAC and AIFF uncompressed. That's good news for me. Those are formats that I commonly work with for the MacCast. an arpeggiator available in the Smart Keyboard, adjustable velocity settings for the touch instruments, and numerous enhancements, including the ability to fade out and offering improved audio import options. So a significant update if you are a GarageBand for iOS owner. I have to wonder on the iOS devices, the smaller ones, the iPhone and the iPod Touch, how useful or how easy it is going to be to use GarageBand. I'm curious to start playing around with it. So I'm going to download the update and see how it goes. If you end up using GarageBand on the iPhone and maybe have some tips or tricks to share with us, let us know what you're doing and what you're using it for. I'd be very curious to find out. And of course, the feedback address is maccast@gmail.com. iMessage was one of those big new updates in iOS 5. It's one of the features that I'm actually really enjoying. And 9to5 Mac says that they're getting word that Apple is currently working on getting iMessage working on the desktop for Mac OS X. According to the report, there's some debate internally on whether it should be integrated into iChat or delivered as a standalone application. Personally, my thoughts on Apple's messaging strategy right now, especially on the desktop, is that it is a complete mess. I think I've talked about this on the MacCast in the past, but you know, iMessage, I think, is really a sleeper feature in iOS 5. And the only reason I say it's sleeper is because I think a lot of people are taking advantage of it and probably like it, but don't even realize or know that they're using iMessage because it's so seamlessly integrated into the messaging app that on iOS that you really don't know. I mean, it's just that subtle change from the green color on your send button to the blue color. You get the little line when you're doing a message. So you start out on SMS, it's in green. You get a reply back from somebody on, who's on an iOS device, be it an iPhone running iOS 5 or an iPad, something like that, iPod Touch, and it switches over to blue, and now you're chatting in iMessage, and you're not using up your SMS your SMS data. And that's really cool, and it just happens kind of automatically. And on the desktop, you know, we've got a bunch of different applications for doing messaging now. You got iChat, you have FaceTime for doing video stuff. You can also do video in iChat. And now they're saying they're going to bring iMessage. And if they brought that on as a separate app, that just seems way too confusing. Needs to be that kind of seamless integrated messaging experience, in my opinion. So I think they do need to integrate iChat, FaceTime, and iMessage all onto the desktop and then tie it together in the same way that they do iMessage on iOS with the ability to kind of attach in different accounts and different emails to associate everything together kind of in one place. So taking some of the concepts of iChat, mixing those up with some of the things they're doing with the messaging app on iOS and bringing together this seamless integrated experience. And I think video can happen within that one application as well. So bring in FaceTime, kind of get rid of iChat, video chat, just make FaceTime the thing. Of course, bring along the ability that iChat has to do multiple or sort of conference FaceTimes, you know, more than one person FaceTime. And I think you have something really, really interesting on the desktop. And a quick little iMessage tip for you. If you're wondering how you can currently associate multiple accounts or rather multiple email addresses with your iMessage account or into the Messages app on your iOS devices, if you go into Settings and go into Messages, there is an option that says Receive At, and within there you can add multiple email addresses to be associated with your primary iMessage number or iMessage account, meaning that someone on an iOS device using the Messages app could send you a message using your email address, any email address that you've put into those settings, and then you'll be able to receive that as an iMessage. And then you have the ability also in that same area to set one of those email addresses as kind of your, they call it the caller ID, or the ID associated with your account, so someone will be able to see that when they're messaging you. And that's just a little cool tip that you may have missed when you initially set up your Messages account, especially if you're just using SMS and it's tied to your phone number. So go around. I know that in my case, I've tied almost all of my email addresses that people know to my iMessage account. That way they'll be able to easily find me and message me using the Messages app on their devices. And then one kind of news story that I'm going to use to transition us into our feedback, and I just have a, because I have a little commentary on this. this week that happened was the reports of the impending death of the Mac Pro. There was kind of this whole crop of rumors that are predicting the end of the line for the Mac Pro. I think some of it's coming about just because sales of that line have been slowing. People are kind of pointing to how Apple killed off the Xserve in its Pro line, and also citing its sort of move away, or what feels like a move away from Pro apps with the whole Final Cut Pro 10 fiasco, which I really don't see as a fiasco. I think Apple's trying to just change the dynamic there. We've talked about this before, and if you heard my episode on Final Cut Pro 10, you know what I'm talking about. But you know, there's now these new crops of rumors that Apple is internally kind of debating the longevity or the life of the Mac Pro, or what their next move is related to their Pro systems. And some of it is reportedly predicated on the fact that Intel made an announcement that their Xeon class Sandy Bridge, the next generation of the Xeon processors, have been delayed. They were supposed to be coming out the end of this year, and it looks like it's not going to happen now, at least for another 3 months, probably in early 2012, that those will come out. And everybody was assuming those were the processors Apple was kind of waiting on for the next generation Mac Pros. Sales have been slowing to a crawl. There's now Thunderbolt technology that could solve some of the expandability issues. So all of this is leading to the fact that maybe Apple will discontinue the line. And I think it sounds good in theory, but it might be a little bit early to start digging the grave for the Mac Pros. I think there's still a lot of Pro users out there who crave or need the pure raw CPU power that you get with the bigger enclosure, the bigger box, more fans. Speculation is that maybe Apple instead will put out some sort of super iMac, you know, an iMac with more processors, more cores in it to kind of fill the need, and that possibly you could leverage the OpenCL technology. That's the technology built into macOS 10 that allows you to use the GPU, idle GPU cycles, to kind of do some CPU-intensive tasks, or traditionally CPU-intensive tasks. I was recently on MacBreak Weekly, and I kind of brought this up. We were talking about the same subject, and I mentioned it, and Alex Lindsay, who works for PixelCore, deals with big hardware and big machines having to do lots of processing, specifically related to video and encoding and stuff like that, said that that really doesn't work out with OpenCL because it relies a lot on the drivers from the GPU vendors, and that's always traditionally been kind of an issue, that whole integration of those two elements. So I trust him in kind of knowing that piece of the business a little bit better than I do. I need to look into it a little bit deeper on the OpenCL side. But, you know, there was a report, or I had heard about a report, I think from John Martellaro at Mac Observer. He's another guy who's really smart about server-grade hardware and sort of performance and stuff like that. So if you've never read his stuff over on Mac Observer, you should check it out. But he was saying that there was a report from one of the science industry publications looking at leveraging OpenCL technology and performance, and that they were able to get something like 800 gigaflops out of a GPU, and then combine that with CPU technology to create desktop systems that were capable of running more than a teraflop of raw processing power, which is just, amazing. So there's potential in that technology to leverage it. It just sounds like something's not happening between the operating system and maybe the GPU vendors and their drivers and software and stuff like that to actually make those connections happen. But, you know, it may well be for Apple that business logic will prevail over any kind of loyalty to the Pro market. And that's the thing, is that Pro users are the ones that stuck with Apple through the kind of bad times, all those bad times in the 90s when people were saying, oh, this is the end of life for Apple. It was the Pro users buying the big Apple hardware that kind of kept the company along. And I think they rightfully so feel that Apple might be abandoning them in this kind of push to the consumer market. So they're not getting their loyalties reciprocated from Apple. But unfortunately, I think we have to face it that the pro market for Apple is a smaller and kind of ever dwindling piece of their bottom line. Apple's making a lot more on devices like the iPad and the iPhone in terms of profit margins, iMac sales, and notebook sales, especially. Apple's notebook lineup, including the MacBook Air, are really kind of driving the company's revenues, at least on the Mac side. And yes, there's a market for the Mac Pro, but it is smaller. And someone also pointed me out to me recently, and I almost hesitate to mention this because I know I'm going to get some feedback on it, but I think it's true. And it goes for geek users like myself, as well as pro users. You know, we tend to be the most vocal and most finicky and demanding users when it comes to changes and the types of systems and things that we want. And so we put a lot of pressure on Apple, kind of demanding what our needs are. And when you're the small portion of the market, but you're the most vocal one, that always doesn't really jive with the business side of things. You know, you kind of become those annoying users out there, and we don't make a lot of money off them. So it makes it easier for us to kind of be ignored in some cases, as much as we don't like that. And it's hard to, for those of us who like to think that Apple is this sort of better than the rest of them company, it's hard when the reality comes around that at the end of the day, they are a business and they are beholden to stockholders and bottom lines and making revenue projections and all those other things that go along with a business. And when 90% of your business is over here and only 10% of it, or even a smaller portion of it, is over there, your business decisions get guided by those numbers. It's just a fact of life. And, you know, Apple is not excluded from it as much as we'd like to maybe believe that. And you start looking at technology, and there are solutions out there. There are alternatives that Apple could leverage to kind of keep the pro market in the hardware they need, in the solutions that they need, but maybe not have those big giant Mac Pro boxes. And we talked a little bit about this at the Mac Computer Expo when I did my keynote. And if you heard the episode that I put out on that, you heard us talk about maybe a notebook system or maybe a smaller desktop system that still has the processing power in it, but maybe not the expansion options, you know, all the PCI card slots. Because what Apple can leverage now is the Thunderbolt technology, which is just external PCI Express. So we can have this breakout box, and Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer called it a Thunderbox at the MCE thing, and I'm chuckling now because I've since found out, those of you who are in Australia and New Zealand are probably rolling on the floor right now, I guess Thunderbox is a slang term down under for a toilet. So probably from a marketing perspective, that's not the name they're going to end up going with. But you get the idea. The idea is that Apple could manufacture this breakout box that has additional functionality, additional expansion, maybe additional storage options, either SSD or some sort of fast external storage. And it could help keep them going, at least for the middle ground, kind of semi-pro market. And what happens with the true high-end pro market, the science fields and high-end, you know, education, those guys that need this raw, massive horsepower, they need the 12 cores. In the long term, Apple might not have a solution to that. It might just be too highly specialized, and you might be looking at needing to go with some sort of customized Linux level system, which they've had in the past and they use now, and it's probably going to be something that you're going to have to rely on more in the future. It just seems like a market that's not financially making sense for Apple. And for those of us who were there in those lean times and were loyal to the core, unfortunately, I don't think that's going to come back to us. I think Apple is going to have to go where their business is and where the sales are driving them. And right now, it's just not seeming like that small percentage of the pro market is it. But I think they're going to have solutions for that market for the time being. I think we're going to see some revs in the future to the Mac Pro line. I think, you know, some of the doom and gloom predictions that are happening right now, I think, are a little misguided. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be a few years coming. But I think we do need to prepare ourselves that that's probably not the direction Apple is moving in as a company. They are moving more toward the consumer market, maybe toward the semi-pro market. And that's where they're going to be focusing their energies. I received an awesome surprise in my email box last week because I heard from an old friend of the MacCast, somebody we haven't heard on the show in a while, and I'm glad he's back and sent us something new, and I hope he's back to stay because I love it when he sends along his tips. And it's John Chambers from the 1 Minute Tip Podcast, and here's what he had for us.
Hello, this is John Chambers from the 1 Minute Tip Podcast with another installment of the MacCast 1 Minute Tip. The goal, to help new Mac geeks become more efficient and seasoned Mac geeks to say, huh, I didn't know that. And uber Mac geeks, well, this will only take a minute. So let's get started. Today's tip, making and recapturing aliases. So as your hard disk drive begins to fill up with stuff, you need to find different ways to organize your content. An alias is a great way to help with this issue. An alias is a symbolic link to a document, file, folder, or volume. Making an alias is easy enough. Select the item, and then go to the File pull-down menu and select Make Alias, or use the keyboard shortcut Command-L. Now remember, this alias can be a music file, a folder, or maybe an application. But a faster way to make an alias is to press and hold on an item, hold down the Option and Command key, and then drag the copied alias, not the original, to a new location. So one of the real benefits of an alias is the file is very small in case size. Aliases will also keep track of their originals, be it a file, folder, or volume. To find an original of an alias, all you need to do is select the alias and then choose from the File pull-down menu, Show Original, or the keyboard shortcut Command-R. Now there are a few things you need to note about aliases. When throwing an alias into the trash, the original will not be affected. And when the original file can't be found, you'll be given the choice of fixing the alias or deleting it. And of course, double-clicking on an alias will open the original. And one cool trick, if you select multiple aliases and find their originals, the originals will pop up in multiple windows. So aliases can really cut down your click time in the Finder. For more Macintosh tips, check out the 1 Minute Tip podcast and videocast at www.1minutetip.com. This is John Chambers, and thanks for listening. And now back to Adam and the MacCast.
There's John with the 1 Minute Tip. If you haven't heard his podcast before, you should go check it out at 1minutetip.com. A great show and just little short tips. He does a bunch of different versions of it. And actually, he has a brand new podcast he just started that is an iCloud podcast. So I know a lot of you have questions about iCloud. You can check out iCloud.com. And if you want kind of a more in-depth look at aliases and symbolic links, which is another type of alias, you have to actually use a third-party tool or create them in the terminal. If you want to know more about that, I did a whole MacCast member episode on that, episode 36, and you can get that by becoming a member, and you get more information on how to do that over at member.maccast.com. Are you ready for kind of a little mini rant? I don't think I've gone on a rant in a while. I do it every once in a while. This isn't going to be a really big one, but something has cropped up over the last couple of weeks. I've received a number of emails from you about the switchover with iOS 5. Apple made a change to moving to the music app from the iPod app, specifically on the iPhone and the iPod Touch. And on the iPad, we have the music app, but the music app itself on the iPad is completely different than the one that is on iOS. And the version on the iPad, this thing is, in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinion, completely broken. I mean, it is terrible. We talked about this on the We Have Communicators podcast, and I didn't even realize they were talking about the iPad version. I was confused at first when they were bringing it up, because I was like, oh, on iOS, I don't see all these changes. The reality is I don't use the music app on my iPad all that much, but when I started receiving these emails and I started looking into it, I now understand sort of what people are talking about. The problem is that it has this whole completely different UI. It's kind of this strange retro kind of thing, I think. These little brushed aluminum sliders. I think the little scrub bar indicator is supposed to look like an old school radio dial, you know, tuner line. It's just this little orange line. But the problem with that is it makes it really hard to grab. When you're going through the views, some of the views, the song view is fine, but when you go into artists or albums or podcasts, there is no way to get a list view. You kind of get this album art view, and you tap the thing and it flips around and then you get the list view, but you can't just get a raw list of all of the artists and albums and things like that. You have to do this kind of drill down thing. So it takes multiple touches on the iPhone and iPod app, music app. They have this cool feature where if you can't see the whole song title or track name or artist name, you can tap and hold on that area in the list and a little pop-up will come up and show you the full information. That doesn't work on the iPad app. I have no idea why. It's just completely inconsistent. And this is, I think, symptomatic of a problem that I've had with iOS and now Mac OS X and sort of what Apple is doing with their user interfaces. And this came up also on the Mac Break Weekly I was just on this week, that Apple is really kind of changing the UI rules on us. And it's introducing a lot of inconsistency. A lot of people are complaining about the new Contact app and the new iCal app, the look of that in Mac OS X, and I think for good reason. It's inconsistent in terms of how it works. It's confusing. They aren't following guidelines between apps, which in the past for me kind of made using the Mac, that was a lot of the ease of use and the usability came from the fact that I can launch different apps. They have a similar look, they're familiar, they're comfortable to me, and I know where to go to find things, and I know how to access different things. Now, even within Apple's own apps, the apps that are written by Apple, we're starting to get these inconsistencies, and I think it makes it very hard to use the different applications. And the music app on the iPad, I think, is a great example of this. We've gotten familiar with the iPod app. We know how to use an iPod. We know how it works. Now they're changing the rules on us, and I can't figure out how to do anything. And a lot of the features are being stripped out and removed and taken away. And a big one with the music app, a lot of the features are related to podcasts, which are a big deal to me. I think they're probably a big deal to you because you listen to podcasts. But for example, on the iPad music app, when you go into podcasts, there are none of the advanced features that we're used to on iOS devices. So there's no way to email the podcast. There's no 30-second skip back option. There's no notes. So I take a lot of time and effort to put in show notes into the metadata. I put in a bunch of album information into the metadata. And you can bring that up on the iOS version of the music app. But you can't when I say iOS, I mean iPhone and iPod Touch. So that's not quite accurate. I'm just going to call it the iPhone version. And when I say iPhone, I mean iPhone and iPod Touch. In that version, you can get all that information and data. You just tap on the album art and it kind of fades up. That option, not there on the iPad version. Same app, same name, totally different interface. And I don't know what that's all about. Another big one is playback speed. On the iPhone app, you can change the playback speed by tapping the little, 1x, 2x, half x icon and toggling between those. Worse, a number of people have emailed me to say that their podcasts on the iPad, when they play them back on the iPad, are stuck at half speed. Well, there's no control on the iPad app to change that, so you're stuck. You cannot work with that. It doesn't support chapters or links or changing album art in the enhanced podcast. Again, another thing that I spend an hour or more every episode when I'm doing the editing to add in that functionality, and a lot of you have written me to tell me how much you appreciate that and how much you like that. Well, if you listen on the iPad, all of that work is for naught because none of those controls are there. So I don't know if Apple is not supporting podcasts anymore or they're deciding that they're not going to support them anymore. Still a big feature built into GarageBand, so I have to imagine that, and built into iTunes. I mean, a big part of iTunes is the podcast, so I don't think they're abandoning it, but man, they're making it look like they are when you look at the iPad version of the app. So completely frustrating, and I know some of you have been frustrated, so I just wanted to mention that. On the podcast front, what I can tell you is if you're frustrated with the lack of some of those features that I was mentioning, probably the best thing you can do is turn to some of the third-party apps that are out there, and there are some really good ones. Two of my favorites are Downcast and Instacast. I think there's another one that people use, and I can't remember the name of it. I know that Podcaster is still out there and has been around for a while, and a lot of people like that. I like Downcast and Instacast because they support all of the advanced features, the chapters, the multi-speed, skip back, skip forward in some cases. They support streaming, so you don't have to download if you don't want to. You can download for offline listening. You can do it all directly from the app. So a lot of great advanced features. They also support accessing the password protected podcasts, which none of Apple's music app does not support that. So you cannot get the member version of the MacCast directly on your iOS device. You have to get it through iTunes and then sync over if you're using Apple's applications. But if you get Downcast or Instacast, they both support that feature. So that's your alternative if you've been frustrated, especially on the iPad side of things. And I probably should also mention that Instacast, unfortunately, does not have native iPad support. It's an iPhone app. So if you use it on the iPad, you're going to have to double scale it up. So I would go with Downcast. That's why that one's my favorite. It's universal, and you can use it on both sides, and it's really great. So check that out if you've been looking for something to listen to podcasts on your iPad. When Apple announced that they were going to be transitioning MobileMe over to iCloud, a lot of questions started coming up about how Apple would roll out cloud services and things like that. And now that iCloud is with us, I think we still have a lot of questions about iCloud, how it all works, and we're all trying to kind of wrap our heads around it. I think there's still a lot of confusion surrounding this technology. I know I'm confused. I don't know about you, but I'm figuring it all out slowly but surely, and I know there's lots of questions, and this week I got this one from Seth.
Hi, Adam. This is Seth from Boston. I'm a longtime listener, but first-time caller. You were my first podcast I ever downloaded when I first got the iPhone back on June 29th of 2007. I had a question about iCloud and about syncing for families. I read that article that Macworld had regarding, and you talked about it as well, about having multiple iCloud accounts within a family. But I'm curious if you know how to set it up so you can have certain aspects synced across your family, but not all of them necessarily. So, for instance, my wife and I both have iPhones, and we'd like to have the same contacts and calendars on our phone, or at least some of the same calendars on our phones. But the only way I can see to do that, and historically I've used MobileMe for that, as we've had just the same MobileMe account, the only way I can see to do that with iCloud is either to have the same iCloud account or just to manually manage that somehow. I'm wondering if you have any insight into how I can figure that out. One of the reasons I want to have separate accounts is that Siri seems to only be able to figure out that we're one person, regardless of which phone it's on. And if I select my name under Siri, then it says, "Hello, Seth." And if I select my wife's name, then it says her name. So that's why I'm having trouble with it. But anyway, I'm wondering if you have any insight into that, and any help you can provide would be appreciated. Thanks for the podcast, and hope to hear from you. Thanks.
Well, you're going to hear from me because I was curious about this myself. You know, I've been wondering how I'm going to set this up. My wife now has her own iCloud account. As a matter of fact, just set it up this week because she wanted to be able to sync up her email, and she had been using our ISP email, which only offers a POP account, but she wanted to be able to sync it between her iPad and her iPhone and stuff like that. So we got her on iCloud. It was also something that I wanted to do because we have been sharing a single .Mac account, but we really don't share our contacts or calendars or anything like that. So we never really had a good solution for doing this sharing. And one option with .Mac and iCloud as well is you can go through the interface and you can publish calendars through the CalDAV service, and you can share them out that way. But as I was digging into answering your question, I ran across an interesting solution, and I think it's the one that I'm going to use, and I started playing around with it, and it works really well. And it turns out that you can connect multiple Apple IDs or iCloud accounts to a single device. So my first word of caution would be, before you start messing around with any of this, make sure that you back up your contacts and calendars and all your data on both your computer and your wife's computer. We want to make sure that if anything goes south or you suddenly end up with duplicates all over the place, that you have a way to recover from it. The other caveat is that you need to be on iOS 5 and you need to be running OS X Lion for all of this stuff to work. But the idea here is that you have your iCloud account, your wife has her iCloud account, and you kind of have your contacts and your calendars within those accounts that are set up separately. And then you create a third iCloud account that is your family account, kind of replacing that shared Mobile Me account that you had. And to do that, it's pretty easy. You just need to generate a new Apple ID. You don't need to get an email address associated with that. You can use a separate email address that you already have that's not already attached to an Apple ID, or you can, if you want, have it generate a new sort of family.me address, but you're probably not going to use it for that because we're really just talking about syncing address and calendar here. So in my case, I chose to use an existing address I already had in place and didn't get another email account. But go into any one of your iDevices and go into the settings under Mail, Contacts, and Calendars and select the Add Account option. And then down there at the bottom, you'll see the option to get a free Apple ID. Click that and go ahead and sign up for your quote-unquote family. I'm just going to call this the family Apple ID, the one that you're going to share between your Macs and your devices. And so sign up for that account. And then once you have that set up, you'll have to go through the whole verification process. So you need to have access to whatever email you use. If you're going to use a separate email address and not have it generate you a new .me address, you'll need to verify that. And the way you do that is you will receive an email to that email address and you click a link and then sign into the Apple ID site and verify that. And you do need to sign in. I made the mistake the first time of just clicking the link, and I didn't realize I actually had to sign into the account to actually verify it. But once it's been verified, then you can actually use that and register it both on your Macs and your iOS devices, the devices that you want the shared information to go between. So you take that new family ID, and what you do is you go into your device, and once again, you go into Mail, Contacts, and Calendars, Add Account, and this time you're going to add an iCloud account using that shared family ID. And you need to do this on each iOS device that you want to share the information on, and you need to do this on each Mac that you want to share the information on. So on the iOS device, you add the account, and then you'll have the option to turn on the things that you want to sync. And in my case, I just chose to sync contact information, calendar information, and reminders. So the cool thing about this is you can also share iReminders through this account. So I turned the syncing on for those things. And then on each Mac, it's kind of a similar process. You go into, you can do it two ways. You can go into iCal and Address Book individually and go into the preferences for those applications. And then under accounts, you'll see that you can add multiple accounts. So you just click the little plus button and you add your family iCloud account or Apple ID to those applications. And then you could also go into the general tab for each application and then set up which account, calendar, or reminder you want to be the default. So when you add new items on your Mac, you can tell it which account to use as the default. In my case, I'm using my personal local iCloud account, and then I just have the ability to add items into the contact group for the family shared account or the contact or the calendars for the family shared account. And so the way this works, and when you're looking at iCal, what ends up happening is you have your iCal iCloud account, and then beneath that you're going to have your family account. Same thing in your address book. You're going to have all of the contacts that are associated with your iCloud account, and then you're going to have all the contacts that are associated in this family account. So some things to note when you're looking at this is that you can view both on the iOS device and on your desktop. You can either choose to view all of your contacts, meaning both groups, your family account and your personal account, or you can drill into each one of those accounts individually. And so once you've set this up, you really need to think about how your data is separated. And anything that you want to have shared in terms of calendar information or address book information, you're going to want to load that into your family iCloud account, that shared iCloud account, and then that'll sync and share between devices. Anything you want to keep separate, and this is what I like about the solution, you can keep in your own personal iCloud account. And that's going to be your primary account on each respective device and Mac. So your wife's accounts can stay separate. She can have some information that stays separate from you, and then you can have the stuff that you commingle and you share in that separate shared account, which is really neat. And so you just need to be careful, because if you have, say, a contact in your address book, and then you also have that same contact in your family shared address book, when you're viewing by all, you'll see it as a duplicate. And so it can be hard to distinguish which information. So I would really think about trying to keep that information separate. The other interesting thing to note is that on the Mac, even though you add the accounts through the individual applications, through address book or through iCal, they also end up being added in the main system preferences under email, contacts, and calendars. You can add multiple iCloud accounts in there. And so I set this all up, played around with it. It seems to be working pretty well. I've only spent about a day with it, so there may be hiccups or little quirks. I don't know, but I read a couple places about people doing this online and having it work very successfully for them. So that's the route I would go. I'd try that, Seth, and see if that works for you. But so far, so good. It's working for me, and I think it's going to be a nice way to kind of, like I said, have shared information and then also still be able to maintain separate information where everything isn't totally shared, which was my old solution, right? Under the old way, I had to share the entire .Mac account and all of the information that went along with that. So I think this solution is actually a little bit better, although a little bit more complicated to wrap your head around and set up, at least initially. But once you get it, it kind of makes sense. And I think you'll see as you set it up, it makes a lot of sense. So try that out. And if any of you have additional ideas or maybe a better way for doing this sharing, be sure to let us know. Send us some feedback. Now, another thing I've been getting a lot of emails about, and it probably makes sense since many of us have new iPhone 4Ss, is some of the issues and problems people have been experiencing with their iPhone 4S. And probably the number one issue that most people are having is related to battery life. And I think it's not just exclusive to the iPhone 4S. I think people who have upgraded to iOS 5 are also suffering a little reduced battery life for different reasons. And it's been kind of hard to pin down. I've noticed in my own devices that it's been inconsistent. Like some days my battery will seem fine, and then other days it's just like draining like crazy, and my usage pattern really isn't changing. So I'm not really sure what it is. Luckily, I think a lot of this stuff is fixable in software, but there have been a couple tips and tricks that have surfaced over the past couple of weeks that I thought I'd share with you, and some of these tweaks have helped in my situation, so they might help you as well. For the battery problems, probably the big one that I think helped the most is there is a new kind of time zone feature that's turned on by default. So what happens is your iPhone will use GPS, and as you move around the country or around the world and go into different time zones, it's polling the location and it will set the time zone automatically. And the setting for it is buried pretty deep, so you might not see this right away. So the way you get rid of it is you go into settings on your iOS device, you go into location services, and then you scroll all the way down to the bottom. And you will see there's this new section called System Services, or I think it's new. I never noticed it there before. So it was either buried really good or it's new. I'm assuming it's new. And then you go in and you'll see all kinds of different options that you can turn on or off there. But probably the number one thing that you'll see is you'll get that little location icon, the little purple arrow icon, and you'll see it next to your setting time zone option, which is on. Go ahead and turn that off. If you're not moving between time zones, if your time zone doesn't change a lot, you really don't need to have that on and set automatically. You can set that manually. So just turn that off, and then it won't be constantly using the GPS and constantly pulling and running down your battery. Geolocation seems to be the number one thing, and we've known for a while that GPS is probably the number one thing to run down an iPhone. If you've ever used a GPS app, you know when you're using it, your battery just gets like sucked out like you wouldn't believe. So another culprit a lot of people are pointing to are the geofenced reminders in iReminders. So if you're using any of those, you might want to either limit them or turn them off completely. And this is another one that's tricky for some people to figure out how to turn off, especially if you set the geo reminder using Siri. So if you said something like, you know, remind me when I get home to take out the trash or to feed the cat. then it was set automatically. This geofence was set up automatically. So to get rid of it or to turn it off, what you do is you go into your reminders, you go into the details of the reminder, and then you go into the remind me portion of the reminder, and then you'll see a little toggle switch that says at location, and you just turn that off, and that will get rid of your geofence. Now, of course, if you want to use the geofence, you're going to want to leave that on, but once again, the more of these that you have on, it seems to affect the battery life more, and at least that's the theory. Another common theory about where the battery drain is coming from is related to notifications in a couple different areas. One that I don't think is probably very practical to turn off, but some people are saying is a culprit, is calendars in the notification center. So notifications, and specifically the notification center, that's the little panel that when you slide down from the top of your iPhone, you get the little panel with all your notifications in it. People are saying that your calendar reminders that show up there can drain the battery for some reason, and that you might want to turn off calendars from the notification center. And the way you do that is you go into your system settings, you go under notifications, and then you can control one, where notifications show up, and then also how they show up and which ones are in notification center. I like to have my calendars in notification center, so I left that one in there. But you know, if you're having really poor battery life and you notice turning that off makes things better, it may be worthwhile to you. For me, the one thing that I am limiting more in Notification Center is notifications on the lock screen. And this is just my own personal theory. I think it's helped, though. I think the reason is that if you constantly have push notifications coming in, push has always been kind of one of these things that has led to lower battery life. You know, it's having to check or actually receive these messages, and then your screen turns on, it pops up, and it displays something. If you have a lot of those going on, and almost every app is going to want to display notifications on the lock screen, if you have a lot of that going on, that's going to affect your battery life. So reducing that seems to have worked well for me, because I don't need every application notifying me on the lock screen, just the really important stuff. So trimming that list down has seemed to help. The last thing related to battery life that a couple people have mentioned has really helped is doing a full restore of the operating system and setting up the device as a new device. So not restoring from backup. And this is an absolute last straw for me, because if you do that, it means you're going to have to reset all of your sync options, resync all of your data manually, set up all your settings. So for your music and how you want your podcast synced up and stuff like that. I mean, it's an undertaking. It's not something to be taken lightly. You have to reset up your voicemail passwords, your email settings. You have to do everything from scratch. And not only that, for certain applications, you lose your app data because that's in your backups. So things like saved game states, your Angry Birds progress and stuff like that, if you do not restore that from the backup, that is going to get lost unless it's somehow stored in the cloud and can be re-downloaded to your device. I don't know how iCloud backup plays into this because I haven't done that, but I would imagine that's the same thing as doing a restore and then restoring from backup, you know, locally through iTunes. So that's not going to help in this situation. You have to set it up as a completely new device, but that's like setting the device up from scratch. So just be aware of that if you're going to go this route, and I would use it as a last resort. So that's battery life and some of the issues people are having with their 4S. The other issue I heard about this week that I have not experienced, but I don't use a wired headset, is an audio echo. So they're saying if you use the iPhone or iPod headphones when you're making phone calls or doing Skype calls or something like that, that very often, eventually, you'll start getting an echo. And my theory on this, and I didn't read this anywhere, but my guess is that it has something to do with the noise canceling in the software. So there's a noise canceling mic on your iPhone, and maybe because you're plugged into headphones, that gets off somehow. It's like trying to do noise canceling, but it's not getting any input. So maybe that results in this kind of echo going on. I don't know. But apparently you can fix it during the call by briefly just enabling the speakerphone on your device and then disabling it while you're still on the call. So that'll kind of reset things. So that's really more of a workaround than a fix. This is something Apple is going to have to address in software. I think they can do that. Hopefully that'll come in the next update. Also, the battery problems. Again, I think these are related to just how the software is set up. And Apple has been reportedly soliciting feedback from customers who have been experiencing battery issues. I had one of you email me to say that you were contacted by an Apple engineer and that they installed some monitoring software on your device to collect some data to find out about battery usage and get that sent back to Apple. So we've seen a couple of reports of Apple engineers reaching out to people to do that. So they're aware of the issue. When and if a fix is coming, we really don't know at this point, but hopefully it's in the next update. I think they're taking it pretty seriously because they made a big deal about the iPhone 4S having improved battery life, and most users, it seems like, aren't experiencing that. So a couple little tips and tricks to fix some of the iPhone battery issues. For this next little section, we're going old school because I received a voicemail from Tim Chatton, and I'm going to plug his podcast because he didn't do it in his audio segment. So Tim does the iPod Possibilities podcast. You can check it out on iTunes if you'd like. But sounds like Tim got an old iPod, a really old iPod, a classic one, and not the current classic, the true classic, first generation one, and was encountering some issues.
Hi, Adam. This is Tim Chatton. I've got a question for you and your listeners. I recently got the original iPod, the old FireWire 400 styled one, and it works great. The problem is I can charge it, I can do a lot of kind of stuff, but when I hook it up to my Mac Mini through a FireWire 800 to 400 adapter, it will charge the iPod, but my Mac, it doesn't recognize it. It won't mount on the desktop. It doesn't show anything under the system profile information, and iTunes won't even see it. I'm curious, is this a problem with FireWire adapters, 800 to 400? I've got the Moshi one. Or is this a problem with old iPods? Has Apple discontinued support for these old FireWire iPods with iTunes and the Mac OS? I've tried this under Lion. I've tried this under Snow Leopard. I've tried using iTunes version 7. Nothing seems to do the trick. If you or your listeners know how to get this iPod mounted and working again, I'd be greatly appreciated. I've tried booting up into disk mode on the iPod. Nothing seems to work. So if you or your listeners know how to get an original first-generation iPod working on today's Macs, I'd be greatly appreciated. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Tim. We're going to try and help you with that. I don't know what the answer is, but the community might have the answer. I have some theories and I have some guesses based on my own experiences. Now, I don't have an iPod that old anymore. The oldest one that I have is I think it's a fourth generation iPod Photo, a 40 gigabyte iPod Photo. It has a iPod dock connector and can connect via USB. I also have a fifth generation iPod Video, and that again is a USB dock connector iPod, but they're pretty old, and I hooked those up on USB. Took a while for the batteries to recharge up, but when they finally came up, I had the same experience. They did not mount or show up in iTunes. And what I did was I just kind of left them for a while, and even when it came up and they mounted, I think, on the desktop first, but still didn't show up in iTunes, and I'm using the latest version of iTunes, iTunes 5. So my first theory was that maybe the version of iTunes makes a difference in your case, that maybe newer versions of iTunes won't support that older iPod. But I was only thinking that because I was having the same experience. I plugged it in and it wasn't showing up, but it did mount on the desktop, and I thought that was odd. Well, I kind of left one of them just plugged in and went back to working, and then suddenly it just eventually showed up in iTunes. iTunes popped up and started doing its syncing thing, and I was able to check it. So it might just be a matter of you have to wait for a bit for, I don't know if the battery has to come up to a certain level or what's going on there. The other thing that I tried on the iPod Photo, because that one didn't come up, I eventually ended up, while it was still connected, doing a reset. So holding down the menu and the select buttons for several seconds until it rebooted. And when I did that and it finally came back up, again, after a pretty long delay, it eventually popped up and showed up in iTunes. So that worked for those devices. I know they're a little bit newer than the one that you're dealing with. Not sure on the whole FireWire 800 to 400 adapter thing, but that really shouldn't make a difference. I think it's more related to operating system version of iTunes and the version of software that is on the iPod. That one just may be too old. And if it is, then probably the only solution that you're going to have is to find an older Mac with an older version of iTunes, plug it into that, something more in line in the generation of the iPod itself. Maybe iTunes 3, iTunes 4, something in that range. 4 should be fine. iTunes 4, I would imagine, would mount an iPod like that. And see if you can get it working that way. But you're going to have to get your hands on a Mac that has that version of the software, which could be tricky in and of itself. If anybody else out there has a first-generation FireWire iPod and has got it working with the current version of OS X and the current iTunes, let us know what the trick might be. And I'll try and pass that along to you, Tim, if I get that information. But that's my theory and my guess at this point. In keeping on the topic of syncing iOS devices, I actually had a couple syncing questions this week. So next question I have came from Dean, and this one's more modern, related to the new Wi-Fi syncing that's in iOS 5.
Hi, Adam. My name's Dean Shear. I've installed the latest version of iOS 5 on my iPhone 3GS and also the latest version of iTunes on my MacBook Pro, but that's operating with 10.5.8, which is simply a Leopard. And I want my iPhone 3GS to sync wirelessly over my Wi-Fi router while the phone is plugged in. But it won't do that because there is no option within iTunes to check for Wi-Fi syncing. So I was wondering this. I was just told that I am going to be receiving as a 15th year anniversary gift from my company, a new iPad 2. Will I be able to set up my iPhone 3GS to sync wirelessly over Wi-Fi using the iPad 2 and its updated version of iTunes? That way I can bypass the version that I currently have on my MacBook Pro, which I don't want to update to Line. It's a rather older laptop, and I just don't think that it would be worth doing that. Any insight that you can give me on this, I'd surely appreciate. Thanks.
Well, I think I can give you some definite insight on that one, although it was kind of hard to find, which is odd because Apple does not put, apparently, right there up front on its website, the requirements for Wi-Fi syncing. I had to dig down in the support articles quite a bit to find this information. I had read about it on some websites, but nobody really had confirmation or direct confirmation, you know, pointing to an Apple article to state this. But it looks like Wi-Fi syncing requires, of course, iOS 5, but also that you be running version 10.6.8 Snow Leopard or later on your Mac. And I'll have a link to that tech info article with that information in the show notes at maccast.com if people want to check that out. So that is confirmed. So your option, I don't know what system you have, your MacBook Pro, but if you can upgrade it to Snow Leopard, that sounds like it's going to solve your problem. Just getting the iPad 2, which is awesome, by the way, congratulations on getting that, and congratulations on 15 years at your company. That's wonderful in this day and age. But just getting that iPad 2 is not going to make a difference in this case. You're going to be running the latest version of iTunes 10.5. And it's really tied into the operating system for the Wi-Fi syncing. So you're going to have to upgrade to Snow Leopard at the very least if you want to get that feature enabled. As a side note, I just want to mention I've received emails from a number of you who have iPhones or iPod Touches who have been saying that you've turned on the Wi-Fi syncing, but it's simply not working even when you connect to power. And looks like the fix for that, if you've run into it, is to restore your device from iTunes. I have had a number of people who have said they couldn't get it to sync no matter what they did, made sure it was on the same Wi-Fi network, tried resetting the Wi-Fi settings, tried resetting the router, tried reinstalling iTunes. Reinstalling iTunes did work, I think, for one person, so you might try that first. Just, you know, re-download iTunes and install it right over top of your current version. But most people reported the most success with just simply restoring iOS to their device. And in this case, you can just do the regular restore and restore from backup, so you don't have to worry about your data. Just make sure you do a full backup before you do the restore procedure, and that seems to fix the issue. But in your case, Dean, you're going to have to upgrade your software. I think there's no way around it if you want to use the Wi-Fi syncing. But, you know, you don't have to use the Wi-Fi syncing. It's nice, but I have to be honest with you, it's slow. So the first sync, I guess you're fine. If you're just doing incremental syncs, it's okay. But you know, you flick on a 2 gigabyte movie and doing over that over Wi-Fi, I guess if you're sleeping, it's not a big deal. But it's not the fastest process in the world. I still prefer to hook up a cable, just personally. And then I've been having this back and forth email conversation with John, who has been looking to consolidate his notes that are on his desktop and the notes that he's been storing in his iPad. And he's been using two different applications for the different locations. On his desktop, he's been using Markspace Notes, which is part of the Missing Sync software from Markspace, which is great software. It gives you a little bit more control over how you sync information between your iOS devices and your desktop. And then he's also been using on the iPad an application called iNotes. I'm not super familiar with iNotes, but it's a standalone application that you can use for storing notes on the iPad. And what he wanted to do was a couple things. Bring all of his notes together, get it in a single location, and then be able to, on his iOS devices, set a passcode lock. So if he lost a device, someone couldn't just get in and read his notes. And I found out later in the conversation that he really also wanted encryption on his notes to protect some of the sensitive data. Now, in looking into this, I noticed that Missing Sync offers a free companion iOS application, actually a couple of them, for working with their Markspace Missing Sync software. So they have something called Flick Notes, Flick Tasks, and Flick Documents. And the Flick Notes application does offer passcode locking. So that might be one solution for you, John, just to use that application and see if that doesn't work for you, although it doesn't look like it provides the encryption. When we initially started having this conversation, my first thought was that he may want to migrate to Evernote. The problem with that is it would be a hand process. There's no real easy way to import notes from another application into Evernote, at least not one that I could find. I did a little research on this. There is XML format that Evernote uses. You can export out of Evernote in this Evernote XML format and then import back in, but I couldn't find a lot of tools out there for migrating between different applications. And then good thing about Evernote, though, is that it has good support for the Mac desktop and it has good support for iOS, and it also supports passcode lock if you're an Evernote premium subscriber. So you have to pay $45 US a year to get that, and that enables the passcode locking on iOS. For free, they do have built-in ability to encrypt and decrypt portions of text notes. So the way you do that is you select part of the note that you want to encrypt, or all of it if it's a text note, and then you can right-click and choose the Encrypt Selected Text option, and then it gives you a pop-up. You can enter a passphrase to set a lock or to encrypt the data with, and then it is encrypted. And that is supported both on the desktop and on iOS. On the iOS side, you can only decrypt and read the information. You can't unlock or decrypt the information permanently. On the desktop, you can actually click a and get a little drop-down that allows you to decrypt the information just to read it, or you can completely unencrypt it if you no longer require the encryption. Evernote was probably the best solution that I could come up with. If you don't need the passcode locking ability or the encryption and you just want something that will sync your notes, just using the built-in notes inside the Mail application and within the Notes app on iOS works really well. It's built-in, easy to use, and you don't have to get any extra stuff. It syncs through iCloud, and you can get your free iCloud account and set that up. So that's an easy way to go. But again, it doesn't offer some of those security features that you're looking for, John. The other way to go is to use some sort of application that syncs notes through, say, something like Dropbox. And I actually use an application called Nebulous Notes that I really like a lot. I've also played around with Plaintext from Hogsbay Software, and there's Notesy. Notesyapp.com. All three of those are great, simple note applications that do syncing through your Dropbox account. And that's easy to set up and it's free. The applications, each one of them, I think, are a couple bucks. I can't remember the pricing. Plaintext might be free. I don't remember. But you can check those out and that might be a way to go. Although, again, you're not going to get the encryption or the passcode locking. But in that case, what you might consider doing is using a security application like 1Password for storing your sensitive notes. It has a notes section built into it, and that syncs through Dropbox, and you have that information available within the desktop app, 1Password, and on the iOS version of the application. So you just would separate your notes. You could keep your, you know, non-sensitive notes in something like Nebulous Notes, and then use 1Password for your encrypted sensitive data. And that's actually what I do. I use those two applications for my different types of notes, and that works pretty well. I also have started playing around with the Evernote encryption thing, but I don't want to pay the extra to get the premium account to get the passcode locking. 1Password, by the way, has passcode locking. It's just part of that system. It actually has a double passcode lock in a way, because you also have to enter in your 1Password password to actually unlock the data file to get access to the information. So you can set up multi-layers of encryption and protection, and that makes me feel secure. So that might be the route to go for you. And the last thing I have for you today is a little bit of feedback from Jim on some comments I made about iOS file management. I think this was related to the conversation I was having with David Sparks about iPad at work, and I was commenting on the presentation I gave at MCE about the fact that we have to think about the iPad a little bit differently when it comes to file management. And it made sense to me that applications kind of own their documents. Well, Jim had a little bit of a different opinion, and I wanted to share that.
Hey, Adam, this is Jim. I listen to your Maccast, and I really enjoy it, and keep up the good work. I was just listening to the episode where you were talking in a forum about iOS and about apps being the key to your files instead of using a folder like Dropbox. And one thing came to mind. Why do I like using files and folders? It's because what if I don't want to use the same application to access, to edit that data? It's all well and true that it's good to access an app via, access data via its app if it's some custom database thing. But what if it's like, it's a JPEG file and you're going to edit it. You might edit it in Photoshop, or you might edit it in Flickr or Picasa or some other online thing or some other tool on your computer. Why should you always be tied down to one app? And so what's the model look like when you might want to use different tools to edit the same data? Maybe that's a diminishing use case. Maybe that's just something that's going to be increasingly rare. But I know myself, I use OpenOffice on my Mac, but at work we use Microsoft products, and you know, I don't often have to make the bridge between those two things, but you know, it's nice to know that I can send someone a file. You know, maybe that's kind of clouding the issue, but anyway, just a thought. Like, what if you want to access some file with a different application? How do you move it out of one app into the other? There's got to be some way to see the files somewhere, and so you can choose a different application to open it with. Is there some common pool or something, or, you know, maybe Apple can build that into the model in some nice, neat, tidy way.
And I think they can. You know, I think you have a very good point there, and I hope I didn't cause any confusion in the comments that I was making, because I wasn't really defending the model. I was just kind of saying, from the perspective of, if we're going to start using the iPad beyond web and email, doing more with it, we have to kind of accept what Apple has given us so far. And it's certainly not perfect. There's certainly room for improvement. And I think the improvement comes, as you mentioned, from the cloud and from the OpenWith options that are built into iOS, and more developers supporting that. Those are the keys to making the file system on iOS devices work a little bit better. The point is that apps are smarter on iOS about the files that they can manage and deal with, and we don't have to think about those things. I didn't mean it to sound like once you had a file in an app, it was impossible to get it out, because that's far from the truth, even today. Yes, it could get better. The problem that I have now is that the iOS sandboxing makes things tricky, how it works. But if Apple could possibly centralize the index of the different types of files that are on the system, not necessarily move them out of the applications that create them, they could still be stored within that sandbox area. But if we kind of write out to a centralized database, kind of like how Contacts works, right? or how the photo library works. Photo library is probably a really great example because almost any application can tap into the photo library as kind of the repository for images. So you put all of your images into the photo app, and then any application that wants to tap into that database can reach in there and grab those files and work with them. So image editors and things like that can directly access images that are in that library. We need a similar kind of thing, I think, for the file system. The files don't have to live within the application, or they can live in separate applications, but if we just have sort of a database that says, okay, this is where all of the Word documents are. There's some over here in Pages. There's some over here in this iOS Word doc editor. There's some over here in Dropbox. And any application that knows how to deal with a .doc file, if it can just show those regardless of that location and say, you can open up any one of these .doc files, I knew where they are and I knew where to go out and get them, then I think that goes a long way to solve this problem. And with Spotlight technology in the underpinnings of the operating system, I think it should be possible. I don't know actually why we don't have it there yet. I think Apple's looking to the cloud and sort of this, you know, documents and the cloud syncing thing as being a solution, but I'm not real happy with that. And I think I've mentioned this before, because part of the problem is I create a document and then it kind of gets pushed out everywhere. There's copies of it all over the place. And I think that's the problem with the current model, is that it's not that we can't get application or files between applications that can work with them. So using, say, a photo editor example, I can bring something into an application like Snapseed, say a JPEG, and then I can send that through the Open With option to some other editor or some other application. So over to Adobe Ideas, or put it into a viewer, send it over to Dropbox. Those sorts of things, I can move it around, but I end up with a copy of that file. So I have the copy that's in Snapseed, and now I have another copy back in my Photos app, or I have another copy back someplace else. So now I have all these multiple copies to manage, and that is kind of hard to keep track of. And so I think that's a little bit frustrating. Apple needs to come up with something to solve that solution. But the bigger point is that, you know, if we're going to use iOS in its current iteration, we have to get comfortable with Open With or using some sort of cloud service like Dropbox that integrates into the applications. And I think that's why, you know, so many developers are being pushed by consumers to add Dropbox support to their apps, because we need some sort of centralized file system. Apple is going to have to do something to address this. I was hoping that it would be something that was addressed in iOS 5. Really wasn't touched too much beyond adding iCloud, and I don't think iCloud is the good solution yet. So you raised some good points and some good concerns, and that's why I wanted to share your comments. So thanks for sending that in. I'm sure many of you have similar comments or suggestions or ideas. Please feel free to send those along, and that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software, get more information and details over at pharonix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook. You can get information and a free demo over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. They make some great software over there at Smile. You can get more information, details, as well as trials at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, you can get cash for your old electronics, old iPods, iPhones, video cameras, still cameras, you name it. They have a huge database that you can search over at gazelle.com. Get cash for your stuff. And big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love getting questions from you, feedback. You can send all of that to maccast@gmail.com, or you can leave voicemail on the hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or you can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype name is The MacCast. And if you'd like to check out show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find all of that at the MacCast website, maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum, forum.maccast.com. MacCast community hangs out there, and they can answer questions and help you with stuff. As a matter of fact, I'm finding now when I do some Google searches for questions that I have, often it's directing me to the MacCast forum. So there's some really smart people over there answering questions. It's showing up in Google searches, and I think that's just awesome and great. So continue to do that. Be part of that community, and it's totally free to sign up. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And that's going to do it. I'm excited because I put out the call last week for some new music. I hadn't been playing new music on the podcast, mainly because I wasn't getting stuff sent in. Well, Ron stepped up and sent me a track. It's actually from an album that he did some guitar and bass work on. So you can find the album. It's for sale on bandcamp.com. I'll have the link in the show notes at maccast.com. But this is some synth pop stuff from San Francisco. The track is called Hello Gorgeous by The Drinking Classes. Enjoy, and I'll talk to you all again real soon. We'll be right back.